We'll call the February 16th Resources meeting to order. It's 3:40. Members present are Senator Elton, Senator Stedman, Senator Dyson, and myself, Senator Wagoner. First item on the agenda is overview of land and water access rights and wrongs. And there will be no public testimony. This is testimony by invitation only. So, carry on.
Thank you, sir. My name is Tina Cunning. I'm a special assistant with the Commissioner's Office of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I served as a co-chair with the state's NAV team alongside a DNR on access issues for close to 24 years. So I was asked by staff to do the overview presentation, or one similar to it, that we do for training programs for staff. We do them at the request of members of the public, organizations, people that want some background information on their access rights in the state. As well as to address some of the places where there are concerns, problems, or issues facing the members of the public in Alaska today. So that's what I've done, is just repackage the same PowerPoint basically that we do in all of our different training programs to provide an overview. This is called Access 101. And feel free to interrupt if you have questions on things. The handouts that we handed out are for the purpose of giving you the background information that we don't go into in depth in the overview, so that if you're really curious about some piece of it, you can look up the background information on it. I believe that Dick Milius from DNR is online.
Yeah, he's online.
He's the DNR representative on the Access and Nav Waters teams, and will answer questions or correct me if I'm incorrect on something I've provided this. Sure. The agency is primarily responsible for access. Can you guys hear me okay? Back there, everybody? Okay. The agency is responsible for access and have a role related to ANILCA and its access provisions on federal lands are DNR, DOT, ADF&G, and the Department of Law. The Department of Fish and Game, because it manages lands, fish and wildlife on all lands in the state of Alaska, it has a primary interest in what happens related to access on all of the lands. We need access for our management, and the public needs access if it's going to hunt, fish, trap, otherwise enjoy fish and wildlife on the public lands, be they state or be they federal. There's a whole history that led up to the current situation, our land status, and the access issues that are before us. This slide, which you have a copy of in your handouts, gives the background of the Treaty of Cessation from Russia through the various allotment acts, the Submerged Lands Act, statehood, ANCSA, and the ANILCA, and then the Alaska Submerged Lands Act, which clarified the land conveyance process related to waters. I'm just going to bring in the three pieces that we're going to highlight today. Under the Statehood Act, effective in 1959, the state was to be able to select almost 103 million acres of unappropriated public lands. Those are lands that weren't already in some kind of military or recreation type of withdrawal. When ANCSA passed in 1971, it allocated 44 million acres to the corporations, and within ANCSA, a section prescribed there be easements across those corporation lands so that public lands wouldn't be effectively cut off by those selections. And 17D2 of ANCSA directed the secretary to withdraw up to but not to exceed 80 million acres of unreserved public lands in the state. This is an additional 50 million acres beyond what was already in conservation system units in Alaska. At that time, there was roughly 30 million acres in Denali, what was McKinley National Park, Glacier Bay National Park, and five wildlife refuges in the state. When ANILCA passed, it fulfilled that provision under 17D2, hence everyone called it the D2 bill, and it actually set aside an additional 104 million acres in conservation system units, not the additional 50 million acres that ANCSA called for. There is a long legislative history to the passage of ANILCA. I have all 41 volumes in my office, and you have read the debates and discussions that have gone on. One of the trade-offs that was made for the extensive additional amount of acreage in the conservation system units was that Congress intended to protect the Alaskan lifestyle. And in doing so, under ANILCA, created a number of provisions to protect access for the residents in Alaska that don't exist on conservation system units in the other states. We're going to go into that a little more. This is a graphic demonstration of what, in the end, after ANCSA and ANILCA, is federal land compared to state land, private lands, in relationship to the lower 48 states. Because the federal lands...
Okay. Now, does this chart and your figures depict what is supposed to be or what currently is?
This is based on what it was projected to be when it's all done.
Okay.
The federal lands will be 60% of the state, this DNR did this based on what it's supposed to be, not what it was in 94 when it was...
Of what it is now. Okay.
So these are the key access provisions that we in the state agencies, and Fish and Game in particular, spend a lot of time dealing with. I've split it out for you a little differently than I'm used to doing it. I've split it out to show that which the state manages versus that what the federal government manages. And we'll cover the state management stuff first.
Let me interrupt you just a minute so we put on record that Senator Seekins just joined us. So, thank you. Okay.
The four items that we're going to cover that the state manages are navigable waters, public trust doctrine, what's known as the two-and-along easements, and revised statute 2477. The state... In 1995, the legislature became very concerned because there was no monies in DNR's budget for doing navigability work, an increasing amount of money in the budget for reserving the 17B easements, and a real concern that the state wasn't out there aggressively asserting its ownership and management of its waterways. In 95, the legislature requested an audit of DNR, Fish and Game, Department of Transportation, and Department of Law. In 1996, the legislative audit provided its recommendations, and under those recommendations, encouraged the government to establish a policy oversight group with these charges to assert ownership and management of navigable waters and protect the public's access to and use of those lands and waters. When the NAV team formed, it was co-chaired by Department of Law, Department of Natural Resources, and Department of Fish and Game. There was a limited amount of interest by DOT. DOT has a limited amount of involvement. So what the NAV team does, the co-chair of the three agencies, is whenever an issue could potentially involve DOT, we contact DOT and include them in the discussions with the information materials, but they're not a regular participant of the NAV team. A key to understanding the navigability issues that the NAV team resulted from the legislature's interest in this is to understand the difference between navigability for tidal purposes and navigability for public use. There are many definitions of navigability. The Coast Guard has a different definition of navigability it uses for requiring Coast Guard six-pack licenses. There are different definitions of navigability under the Army Corps of Engineers for based on when construction is done. But these are the two terms that we in state government are responsible for under the through the NAV team. The navigability for tidal and the navigability for public use. The navigability for tidal is the piece that addresses the ownership of Alaska's waterways. That's the tidelands, the submerged lands that extend out to the 3-mile limit, and the shorelands, which are the land underlying inland waterways. The state of Alaska entered the Union under the Equal Footing Doctrine with the same respect for its sovereign rights and powers to water as the other states. The Equal Footing Doctrine applies to us as the same as others. There were some problems in assuring in the conveyance process, of the state lands conveyance process under our Statehood Act and the native lands conveyance process under the under ANCSA. There are problems in the calculations of acreage. How is acreage of underlying waterways going to get calculated and charged against entitlements? So Congress passed the Alaska Submerged Land Act of 1988 to clarify that those major waterways that are likely navigable would not be counted against the acreage of the native corporations. They would not be counted against, of course, also the state, because the state technically got those waterways at statehood. We got those when we entered title to those underlying lands when we entered the state as a state. Each state has a different navigability definition based on a federal test that was in effect at the time of statehood and subsequent court cases. We've had a couple significant court cases that have affected the title in Alaska, one of the most significant being Gulkana. Under the Gulkana decision, the court determined that a recreational craft could qualify a waterway as a navigable waterway, that the total weight, gross weight, of the craft plus its load was 1,000 pounds, and they also directed that because Alaska had such a poorly developed community system, that a navigable waterway could be considered navigable if it was susceptible to that use, even though we couldn't find documentation to show that that kind of use was occurring at statehood. Another key for title purposes.
So, Senator,
thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, the federal test is water is navigable in law in their natural and ordinary condition. I mean, how does that apply to a stream that freezes in the winter and is used as a dog sled pathway?
This test in Alaska is for the title of the underlying land based on its abilities to hold a craft up to 1,000 pounds. There's a different issue that you're driving at, which is the other navigable waters issue, which I'm going to get to in a minute.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr.
Okay?
Chair. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So this is just strictly the title of the underlying land lease on navigability.
Okay.
The other step we can take in getting title to under the land underlying the navigable waters is this new process under reportable disclaimers of interest, which I'm going to explain. The navigable waters that are the tidelands, the waters over tidelands, the submerged lands, that's from the mean high tide up to the 3 mile territorial limit. These provisions are some of the criteria to qualify for navigability. It's in your handout, so you can look it up. Under shorelands, those lands that are under inland navigable waters, and I will say we all, even those of us that work in this field a lot, commonly use the word submerged lands when we're talking about shorelands. It's technically shorelands are the lands underneath inland waters, submerged lands are lands under marine waters, but submerged lands frequently gets used for meaning both. The lands under the inland waters are those below ordinary high water. If we have the title, it must be navigable under the federal law, must be susceptible for navigation at statehood, meet the Gulkana criteria of the Ninth Circuit Court. And there's an issue related to pre-statehood withdrawals. We own it if the statehood defeated the federal government's claim under pre-statehood withdrawals. We don't own it if the pre-statehood withdrawal included the ownership of the submerged lands, and that's where we go to court on things like Glacier Bay. Under navigability for title, the ownership under navigable waters, BLM makes those determinations as part of the Native Claims Settlement Act conveyances. The certainty of title requires either the quiet title action in federal court, if it's with the federal government, in state court, if it's with a private land manager, or through the recordable disclaimer of interest.
What does the phrase quiet title mean?
It means to take the cloud off. If there's a cloud on the title, if there's a dispute over the title, and if you want to quiet the dispute, that's where that phrase comes from.
So a quiet title is one in which there's no disputes,
there's
no recorded disputes.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Segan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But you can't assert for a quiet title under the Quiet Title Act until the federal government has made some claim of their ownership. Am I correct?
That is correct. And that's where, when we go through this quiet title process, we have to assert that there's a dispute, and then they have to claim they have an interest in it. And when we went to court on Kandik Nation and Black, there was never any proof that they were disputing our claim of ownership on the Black. They never would come out clearly and state they had an interest, but they wouldn't state they didn't have an interest. They just avoided us in the court. And so that was a problem. That was why the judge in the Black couldn't render a decision, even though the waterway was clearly navigable. It is a frustrating situation.
So they can hold their claim of ownership in Kuwait as long as they want to, and until there's something that challenges our ownership, we can't pursue it.
We behave like we own it anyway.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
That's our charge.
And I read Kleinfeld's decision on that Black. It was a good one. But,
yeah. So these are there's 13 water bodies that have been through quiet title action since statehood in 1959. The last one cost close to $1 million. They're very, very expensive. It's not a good system when you think about the fact that we might have 60 million acres in navigable waterways in the state. So in 1976, under FLTMA, there was a provision where people who had a dispute over title, like between the old railroad lines and a homestead, or some sort of dispute because the old survey methods weren't quite right, there was a provision in there where an applicant could go to the Bureau of Land Management and request that the Bureau disclaim any interest in the land, and they could get clear title to the wedge that was adjacent to their homestead that they thought they owned all along, or whatever the case may be. In two years ago, the Bureau of Land Management modified that regulation to allow the states to file to clear title for navigable waters and RS-2477s. They established an administrative process for the state to be able to file an application for a recordable disclaimer of interest. This only works in the cases of navigability where the federal government agrees with us that it's navigable.
Is that
Senator
Sieg? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we talk about use for navigable waters, are we talking, is that connected to the title for the submerged lands? Is that what you're talking about? So it's not the use of the, it's not the navigability, it's the ownership of the submerged lands?
We're strictly talking ownership, we're not talking about uses, okay. Which
right.
Is what I'm going to get back to.
All right.
We're strictly talking title right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Recordable disclaimers of interest are controversial for the purposes of RS-2477s. So to date, the state has not filed an application for a recordable disclaimer of interest on RS-2477s. We're only applying for them on waters. The BLM and state are working very closely together on this, because the more of these rivers that we agree to, that we can go ahead and get recordable disclaimers done on, the better, because then we're not left with a situation where we have to go to court on them. As some of you know, the initial filings for recordable disclaimers of interest were done by DNR and Fish and Game together. We pitched in staff, worked a fair amount of nights, and got our original application in on the Black River. If they weren't going to claim an interest in it back in the court, we were going to file a recordable disclaimer of interest and see if we could get them to claim an interest or not in it. They have given us a disclaimer for most of the Black and its tributaries that we requested. They suspended action on a tributary section that we're continuing to research and get more information on, the susceptibility question and the use question at statehood. So we hope to resolve that soon. Since then, we have filed recordable disclaimers of interest, and we were provided funding by Legislative Budget and Audit to do the research on these. There's been 21 rivers, 10 lakes filed. We have received title to 8 rivers and 2 lakes under the recordable disclaimers of interest process. There are a number of them pending, and we have about 5 more ready to file within the next few weeks. So we're moving these through the system now. There are a number of public concerns regarding the recordable disclaimer process. That early on, we probably didn't do a good job of notifying the public and explaining what these meant. We now have an item that you have in your handouts out there on both BLM's website and on DNR's website. That's the recordable disclaimers of interest frequently asked questions sheet. It's a one-page, two-sided document there that answers questions for the party. One of the most significant questions that people had, if they didn't know anything about it, was, what is this going to do? Does this mean the state's going to come in and issue a bunch of mining claims? Is the state going to come in and shut down subsistence priorities under the federal government? What is the state going to do into this? The thing that we try to get across to everybody is these are the waterways that the state got with statehood. We act like we manage them. DNR will issue mining claims on them since statehood if someone is interested in a mining claim. It doesn't have any effect on subsistence. It doesn't have any effect on other uses within the waterways. These are waterways we got at statehood. We are merely going through a paper process to just get that recorded. That's all it is. There's a short slide, a couple slides in your handout that explain what DNR does under its land management, land and water management regulations. These lands underneath waterways that are navigable are treated the same as any other generally allowed uses on state lands. Unless they're under a special use designation with certain specific restrictions, they are open to the normal uses that are allowed on any general state lands. So that's navigability for title purposes that we deal in on all the time. The other issue on navigability is public use, and this is what's called the public trust doctrine. Under the public trust doctrine, the public has a right to enjoy waterways for those and the resources within those for those purposes that are managed under the state. This is common law. It's a sovereign area of the state. And each state manages its public trust doctrine lands differently. It's evolved through the courts over time. In the state of Alaska, public trust doctrine lands are those between ordinary high water marks or below mean high tide. So obviously some of the waters here are the same waters that we also own the submerged land. But in some cases, these are waters that we don't own the shoreland. But the public trust doctrine lands are those waters and the resources within them that are between the banks of the waterway below ordinary high water. There's a flyer in those handouts that we passed out, which is the excerpts of all the state constitution provisions and state laws on public trust doctrine. And basically what public trust doctrine does is grant the public the right of access over those navigable waters or public waters, that the ownership of the underlying or adjacent land does not affect the public's rights of access on water. No one may obstruct people's conduct of boating, fishing, hunting activities on those waterways. And if it's state land involved, the state reserves to and along easements along those waterways for the public's uses. Under public trust doctrine in the state of Alaska, if you can float a boat on it, you are allowed to float a boat on it. If you can walk up that creek to fish, you may walk up that creek to fish no matter who owns the underlying submerged land. And in that definition, it includes frozen waterways. For purposes of trapping and transportation, you have a right of access on that waterway under these conditions under state statute. So that's the public trust doctrine piece related to public's uses of the waterways, including the frozen state. Now, why do we get so involved in navigable waters and public trust doctrine issues? Ownership affects what kinds of regulations that people or agencies may try to put on the waterways. Federal agencies try to assert their authorities over waterways. If we own the underlying land, then it's just the same as dry land. It belongs to the state. Private landowners at times attempt to interfere with the public's rights to access on waterways. About every 2 years, we get a call from some steelhead fisherman walking up Deep Creek who's confronted by a landowner and told he can't walk there, it's private land, for purposes of fishing. We have a standard form letter we've worked out through the Department of Law that we send to the landowner advising them that the public has the right to access those waters for fishing, boating, and hunting. However, along with that right goes a responsibility of the individuals that are fishing, boating, and hunting to respect the private landowner's rights as well. Don't leave trash, damage the land, don't harass things. So that's part of what we do when we're dealing with those issues. So for the time being right now, the NAV team, which is pretty active, we're dealing with a number of significant issues, include the recordable disclaimers of interest, quiet title actions, some jurisdictional disputes over pre-statehood withdrawals. We've been supportive of the litigation on the Southeast Tongass Tidelands case. We're involved in a number of issues related to avulsed lands, and these are lands that went up or went down very suddenly, like in an earthquake. Who owns the land? In those cases, if there's a sudden change in land, the ownership of the boundary between the land and the water stays where it was before the avulsive action. That's a real hard concept to grasp. So like at Chickaloon Flats, out there off of Anchorage, where the land changed very suddenly with the 1964 earthquake, the boundary line that was in effect between the refuge and the water in 1964, that boundary line is still in effect. As a consequence, the refuge, Kenai Refuge, owns land underneath the tidelands way out into the inlet.
Senator Elton?
But that's only for a dramatic occurrence.
That's only for a dramatic avulsive action.
It wouldn't be glacial rebound or...
There's another piece of law that's related to accretion, and that's where the land changes very slowly. The land maybe goes up real slow or goes down, or as a stream pours glacier materials out, it builds up the land. That's why I listed Mendenhall Refuge on here. That's a place where there's some uplift going on. The gray between what is rebound that's fairly quick but still not suddenly avulsive, that gray has been dealt with by the courts with competing opinions. So there's avulsive action and there's accretion or dereliction, and then there's sort of a gray area that the courts are not totally resolved on those lands that are maybe that goes up over a period of 5 or 10 years.
Or 2 inches a year.
Yeah, that's an area that's very dicey right now.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
We're filing recordable disclaimers of interest. We had two issues that the legislature and the governors have been pursuing in the national level. This map shows you, probably not very well on there, but I think it illustrates. This is the Copper River. Wrangell St. Elias National Park and Preserve is on one side. There's a lot of forest land, state land, native corporation land along all these waterways. The big purple branch that goes up the middle is obviously a navigable waterway. It's been found navigable as land conveyances have moved through. All those purple pieces where BLM has been conveying land has shown it to be navigable. The Gulcana is shown on here in red, which you can't see very well, but it was through the quiet title action in court. A vast majority of those other waterways that you can see on there are obviously navigable, were susceptible to navigability at the time of statehood. But many of those, the federal government is not going to be so quick to say, we agree with you that it's navigable. And then we're going to be back into either having to go to court, or if we have the Navigable Waters Commission, which the legislature has twice passed now and encouraged, we would have a mechanism to try to resolve those waterways so that are marginal. They're not clearly not navigable, they're not clearly navigable at the time of statehood. This is an example of what happens, and then we're out of water. We're going to move on to RS-2477s. This is an example of a waterway that has had a number of land transfers occur over time. This one is in Montana Creek out in the Mat-Su Valley, where two and a long easements were reserved for the state-owned land. It reserved the two and a long easements along the waterway as land moved into private ownership. But when land moved through the federal government to a homesteader, or moved through directly to, say, the university, then it didn't pass directly through the state, then those two and along easements were not reserved. In addition, the legislature didn't pass this statute until 1976, so there was a significant amount of land around communities around the states where the municipalities got their land, some lands, where the two and along easements have not been reserved as the land has gone into private ownership. Consequently, it's frustrating for the public because they have access, they can walk a fair amount of these streams, but not all of them. They get up, they walk along the easement, and they get back down in the stream to move or to fish. And in some cases, there is no easement, in other cases, there is. So this is a complex area that we're having to deal with now. RS-2477, moving right along. Revised statute in 1866, quoted, to quote you, is the right-of-way for the construction of highways over public lands not reserved for public uses is hereby granted. Remember that in 1866, contrary to the little picture I have on here, there were no automobiles. So what did Congress mean in 1866?
I'm kidding. I'd say, my world's always included automobiles.
What did they mean by a highway? Did they mean a road the way people think of it today? The state of Alaska is on record of not believing so. The state of Alaska has asserted that those highways that are public use were in effect in 1866 are those uses that public grant of right-of-way that up until the land was reserved was whatever use, like dog teams. Horses, wagon trails, whatever was being used prior to the land being reserved is what established the public's claim of use as a highway. This is a real controversial area, but in the state, it's been the legislature's been very clear in its statutes defining this and giving us guidance. Even though Congress repealed the RS-247 statute in 1976, the grant of the right-of-way that existed is still valid. You couldn't establish new rights-of-way after 1976, but those rights-of-way that were granted based on public use still exist. The state has the responsibility for the management of those, but each one is going to be determined on a case-by-case basis. A number of years ago, the Department of Interior tried to adopt regulations to regulate the management of those RS-2477s. Congress said that's a state issue. In a budget bill, they gave direction that Congress could not adopt, or that Department of Interior could not adopt regulations to affect the management of RS-2477s until authorized by Congress. From 1993 to 1998, DNR and DOT, under a CIP by the legislature, spent over $1 million researching what started out as well over 5,000 trails nominated, worked on 2,000 trails, determined that at least 602 qualified, and those accompanied the legislation that was passed by the legislature in 1998. By that legislation, the legislature said that they accepted this grant of a right-of-way across the federal lands, and that includes the section line easements. DNR is required to annually report trails to the legislature that they find qualify, and if any of them that were on the list don't qualify, to recommend those for being removed. RS-2477s and section line easements under other legislation specifically says that the state agencies may not vacate a right-of-way unless there's established alternate right-of-way or means of access that satisfies for now and until the reasonably foreseeable uses of the future. This has been an area that has been difficult for some of the municipalities to deal with. I believe that they're coming online and understanding it now. There were a lot of vacations of easements in the early days. For example, if there was a road, somebody might have wanted to request a vacation of an easement. If the original RS-2477 or section line easement allowed dog team travel, or snow machine travel, but the current road right-of-way doesn't allow dog team or snow machine travel, then it's not equivalent access. So the legislature made this clear, and people are now coming into compliance on this. DNR has adopted regulations in two phases. The first phase was adopted in 2001, which defines the public easements and explains what uses are allowed, sets up the process for adjudicating those. The phase two portion of the regulations has yet to be drafted. That addresses the section line easements and the management of utilities. These management of utilities is a complicated piece because the utilities that are built on section line easements, in some cases DOT manages those, in some cases DNR manages those. Even where DOT manages those, there's still a right of the public of access under the general allowed uses. So there's some of that still has to be worked out before those regulations are published. This is just a list of issues that we deal with through the access team. I'm not going to go into these. We mentioned some of them as we were talking about it. So those are the pieces that the state manages. Then there's the sections, the easements and access methods that the federal government manages, which the state agencies are monitoring. This again, this was on that handout I gave you, that it was an AppTeam publication, that glossy brochure. I heard somebody laughing because they got to have a glossy brochure. This again shows the breakdown of what it was in 97 at the time of the legislative audit when we first started the NAV team and started working on dealing with easements through the NAV, easements and access on waterways through the NAV team. Under the Native Claims Settlement Act, the public easement provisions allowed there to be a reservation of an easement across corporation land for public access. This was to be sure that as the corporations acquired their lands, they wouldn't effectively block public lands, state or federal lands that might be on the other side of a selection. This is just a slide that explains the ANCSA conveyance process, the townships, how they were worked out, some of the problems that we had. The 17B easements has taken a fair amount of time by DNR and Fish and Game staff to try to protect public access across those corporation lands to public lands for hunting, fishing, and other public uses. That access is strictly for the access. It does not allow hunting or fishing on those easements. This is strictly to get you from point A to point B. And as we work with the corporations, they have a lot of problems with trespass because those easements aren't surveyed and they aren't marked in most locations. We're trying to work with the public to ensure people try to stay on those easements where they can find them, if they're a historic trail or if they can be GPSed. There's very specific provisions in BLM's regulations of what's allowed on those 17B easements. Certain trail widths determine what kind of mechanized use on there, if it's ATVs or snow machines. There are also 1-acre site easements that can be reserved to do a change in mode of transportation. So if you're floating down a waterway, this is an example along the Yukon River, where the corporation lands are largely right along the river. You see the little dots that are the trail easements. Those get you to otherwise isolated pieces of public lands. And there are triangles, which are the site easements. So if you see the triangles along the river, if you're passing along on the river, you can pull out at that site easement and then take the trail inland to public land. You can stay on that site easement for up to 24 hours and then move on down the river. So this allows people to continue to transport on the rivers. And why do we pay so much attention to these? Well, obviously, if the easement is in the wrong location, it's not going to be helpful to people. There are some issues in the conveyance process related to previous conveyances done before Volcana, which didn't use the 1,000-pound category they were using the prior test. So there's waterways that the corporations had counted against their acreage entitlement. that they need to have corrected. They need to go back to BLM if there's any doubt, have it corrected, and then they can select more uplands. This one at Seldovia is one that's been very dicey for a long time. It's had a lot of complicated issues with it. Right now, BLM has a lot of money that it's grinding into the, what is called the 2009 process to try to get the state's lands and the Native Appropriation Land Masses done. As a consequence, they're moving land much quicker, and we're having to stay on top of it to get those easements reserved. I'm going to move into Anilka now, and we're done with the ANCSA piece. I'm going to crash through a bunch of slides here pretty quickly so I don't put people to sleep. I see fading eyes here. Under Title I of Anilka, there's a real clear distinction that the boundaries of the federal lands do not extend seaward, and that the federal lands regulations only apply to the federal public lands. So if you are an inholder within a conservation system unit, the federal regulations do not apply to your land. The state of Alaska is an inholder. We own millions of acres of navigable waterways within these federal conservation system units, these little fingers of land that we own, and we stay monitoring the federal land management plans between DNR and Fishing Game very closely to be sure that their regulations do not intrude on our jurisdiction on our state waterways. So under the park system, which is Title II of ANILCA, it has general management plans that were written in the 80s as required by the law. They are going through amendments to those management planning processes now. You've heard about some of them. They're called backcountry management plans. They do other management plans. The state agencies monitor these management plans closely to try to protect our ownership and management of our waters, as well as the public's access rights, which were created under ANILCA, which I'm going to come to in a minute. The refuges were created under Title III. They also require management plans, which spell out uses on the federal lands. Those regulations that are subsequently adopted only apply to the federal lands within the refuges. BLM has two units, which are not conservation system units. They are special units under FLTMA, and that's the White Mountains and the Estes units. They too have a management plan. They too have to meet some of the access provisions under ANILCA. The National Forest System has a number of provisions related to activities for the state, including the establishment of various fishery sites on their forest units. The National Wild and Scenic Rivers are conservation system units. These, again, clearly, under one Title I, the federal regulations for the management of the federal lands within a wild and scenic river do not apply to the state's waterway. The National Wilderness System under Title VII, the units of the wilderness system within the Tongass National Forest are conservation system units. The ANILCA provisions that protect public access that I'm coming to are very clearly laid out in ANILCA, apply to the forest wilderness units. Those are the sections of ANILCA that address the specific federal land management. The rest of ANILCA covers public uses. And I'll bet that guy's getting eaten. Title VIII, under the subsistence provisions, has a section 811 which guarantees traditional methods of access for subsistence purposes. And I've quoted it so that you have it in your handout to go back and look up at whatever you want to here. It's a provision that says the secretary shall permit on the public lands for subsistence purposes, the use of snowmobiles, motorboats, and other means of surface transportation. Notice that it says on the public lands. That means that that applies to all the federal lands, including the Tongass and the Chukach. That's all of the BLM lands. This provision guaranteeing this motorized access applies also to wilderness areas for subsistence purposes. Department of Interior has adopted regulations that implement its access provisions. Both Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service have specific regulations which implement this piece of the statute. And we monitor it closely because people forget. Under Title 11 of ANILCA, this is where the TUSs are. And this is what said, the state of Alaska has a poorly developed infrastructure. We have no road system to speak of. These conservation system units are going to lock us up. There was a lot of testimony in the legislative history about it. So Congress tried to establish a unique process for the state to be able to get access across those conservation system units. It set the process up in those same regulations in 43 CFR Part 36. And I brought those with me. They're in the box here. If anybody wants the Department of Interior's Transportation Utility System regulations, I don't pass them out unless you want them, because no one else reads them but people like me and people who want access somewhere. There are a number of other access rights under ANILCA. Valid existing rights that existed at the time ANILCA passed are upheld. There was provisions related to the Stikine River, which I know you know well about. There were other provisions for temporary access. If the state needs to go in and do research on its state land and it can't get there except by crossing a conservation system unit, it's granted access under the temporary access provisions to get motorized vehicle in there to do some kind of exploration. The most impacting section of Title 11 for Alaskans, the part that people fought for hard in Congress, is 1110. And these are the special access provisions that address basic hunting, fishing, recreation, and the access to inholdings. Under 1110A of ANILCA, the Secretary shall permit on the conservation system units the use of snow machines, motorboats, airplanes, and non-motorized surface transportation for traditional activities. This must be compromised by creating those big units to protect our access. The same package that I have in this box down here, the 43 CFR regulations, covers the very specifics about snow machine access, airplanes access, and these other methods. What those regulations say is that these units are open for those types of access until they're closed. And they're only closed when there's a finding of resource damage, hearings in the vicinity, and they go through a federal regulation process except in emergencies. They are allowed a one-year temporary or emergencies, but otherwise they have to go through a federal regulatory process. We struggled very hard, and we have a happy ending to report with the National Park Service for many years on what they called compendia, which were superintendent's orders which restricted public access on the parks. For many years, our team on ANILCA would meet with the Park Service and claim that these restrictions on public access that were affecting hunting, fishing, whatever on the lands were not legal. The snow machine issue you heard know about at Denali was part of this. 2 years ago, the regional director of the National Park Service agreed that the compendious authority had probably been used more liberally than what was allowed under ANILCA. They went through an extensive process to look at their compendia, figure out what were legitimate restrictions on public uses and what weren't, and went through a rulemaking process that went out for public comment. Those regulations were adopted this past year. They were supported by the state of Alaska. They're clean, they don't impact the public, they're only where needed, and they follow clear, precise provisions of ANILCA that they only restrict access where there's damage. We have a number of ANILCA access issues we're still working on, however, and that is, how do you define traditional? When do the restrictions on commercial service permits intrude into the public's uses on the public lands that were protected by ANILCA? How do you define and measure what's a detriment to a resource value? And the Denali snow machine case is still hanging out there for resolution, and part of that case was based around the definition of traditional. The other key access piece under ANILCA that affects us is the 1110B part, and that's the access for inholdings. All of you heard all the articles in the paper related to the Pilgrims issue, which we worked on. What is this access that is given by the secretaries for adequate and feasible access for economic and other purposes? It's very difficult, because of a number of considerations that the federal manager has to take into account. So the inholder's guaranteed a right of access, but does that mean he can bulldoze a 100-foot wide road in there? What is for economic and other purposes? What is adequate and feasible? There's a little bit addressed in the 43 CFR regulations to give guidance, and within that guidance in regulations, The National Park Service put out, it just came out this week for public review, but comment deadline is in May, a guidance for people in applying for their access rights under this provision of ANILCA. And it's out there right now. I'm hearing from Wrangell's residents already, which some of you may be, to see what the public's rights of access are, people's rights of access are to their inholdings for different purposes. The state agencies are going to be reviewing this very carefully to be sure that we're protecting the state's interests in access to its state lands and waters as well. There's some other provisions under ANILCA, which I've kind of gone over. I'm not going to go into them now. They're on your handout. Those are the rest of the federal manager pieces. There are some other questions that we're having to deal with right now. When do the access provisions that are protected under state or federal law apply to some of the other lands that are not general state lands or not general federal lands or conservation system lands? For example, the Mental Health Trust lands has very specific and different provisions. University lands, the Alaska Railroad rights-of-way and its lands. Homesteads that were pre-statehood, they also always have a little bit different background based on what their timing was. Native allotments, you saw in that very first slide, there were many different native allotment bills over time. Each one has different provisions related to it, and we have to have research that goes back into what the timing of the allotment claim was. There's court actions, and then there's the DOT properties. On the ground, we just try to deal with the issues as they come up. In this case, the residents of McCarthy asked DNR and Fish and Game to come out and explain their access rights and what the application process was with the National Park Service to get access to the private lands in the McCarthy area. We did that. We flew out there. We did a work session with the residents of McCarthy. The laws are complex. This is my last slide. They're not seamless. There's conflict in them. They're not clear. We're a new state, and it's going to take time to resolve some of these. But we have a responsibility as a state agencies to all of our citizens, to the inholders, to the developers, to the fishers, to the hunters, to the subsistence users, and to those people who just use and enjoy our state and federal lands. So that's why we monitor all this stuff. And I'm done. Any questions?
Questions?
I got a series here, and I don't know. I know you're from the Fish and Game Department, so.
And DNR is on the phone, so he can answer questions too. I don't know if you want to correct anything I said.
The subject matter what I'm going to talk about and ask questions about is the easement that the state applies to properties when they convey it either to municipalities, the university, or into the private sector. And it's my understanding that the state, through this conveyance process, puts forth a 50-foot public access easement.
That I was discussing.
Right, a 50-foot easement. And that easement can be either above mean high tide or below mean high tide, or it may be both.
Dick? Is he on the phone?
Shirley, can you hear me?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I presume that, it's a little hard to tell who's talking there, but I believe that was Senator Stedman's question. And that is correct that we put an easement we always do it on upland parcels unless there's some physical reason why you can't do it, or in some cases possibly a public safety issue. On the tideland conveyances, we usually do that unless the tideland parcel is already leased and the lease doesn't provide for that easement, because we can't impose it after the fact. So a lot of our southeast tideland conveyances do not have the tune-along easement on the water side, largely because we had already issued leases that did not have those kind of easements.
Okay. The easement doesn't seem to be defined. There's a couple things I want to talk about. One is the lack of a definition and a potential use of those easements. And then reading through the documents and listening to your last question or your last response, there seems to be some flexibility due to topography, but I certainly have never ran into that. And so maybe we could touch on those two issues, and then we'll go a little further.
Senator, through the chair, it's usually we do the statute, I believe, says that we have to reserve an access easement unless it's there's a public interest, or I can't say the exact wording, escapes me at the moment, unless the commissioner determines a reason not to, that there's some public interest in not keeping it. And so it's usually not topography, it's more like if it's a use where you wouldn't want to have public access, like I know we've done some barge landings, for example, where the people who are operating the docking site didn't want the public walking across an area where they're going to actually be moving things from boats to the shore and stuff. So we've not done it in those cases. We usually haven't done it just because of topography, simply because we don't usually have the adequate information to tell whether or not, in fact, you can actually access the shoreline in those locations.
The intent of the easement isn't not to, to ensure that the public has access to the navigable waters?
That is correct. The purpose is to provide the public with access. Well, it's actually along as well. It's to and along, so it's both to provide access to the waters and then also the ability to move along the shoreline. So, for example, one of the reasons for the upland easement is so that at high tide, people can still walk along the shore to either get to, public lands that are further along the shore or just to walk along the shoreline, things like that.
And you cannot build a structure in an easement, isn't that correct?
Senator, that is correct. With the exception of, we have allowed people to build like docks and boardwalks. You can't build a structure that, I should clarify that. You can build a structure if it's something that doesn't prevent the use of the easement. So people routinely have built docks across these boardwalks, things like that. We have allowed people to put boathouses in them, but you couldn't like build a house, a residential structure within the easement.
A house or a deck. Now this 50-foot definition, that's in regulation and not statute?
Senator, through the chair, that is correct. That's in a regulation.
And why would you put a 50-foot access, undefined easement, across a shoreline that can't be traversed at high tide? What's the purpose of that?
Can you repeat that question again, Senator?
I'm wondering what the purpose of putting a 50-foot access easement along the shoreline above high tide that cannot be accessed by the public due to terrain.
Senator, in those cases, it may be, there are probably situations where because of terrain it's not usable, but part of our conveyance is we don't have the information to, if we're conveying like a large tract of land to a municipality or like the pending university land conveyances, we don't have the resources to go out and field check whether or not you can or can't use the easement. When we do subdivisions where we sell land into private ownership, if it turns out that it is physically impossible within that 50-foot easement for the public to use it, we probably wouldn't reserve it if the folks that are on the ground surveying it can come to that conclusion.
A lot of these parcels, I'm under the impression, aren't surveyed with the easement, and some are, but if you can't put a structure, a home or a deck, into this 50-foot easement, and the easement's put in place for to ensure public access along the waterway, I have a hard time understanding the removal of private property rights that doesn't support the end means of access to the public waterway.
Well, we'll say a couple things in response to that. In terms of when we sell the land, if we are reserving that easement, it's actually we're not taking a private property right because we actually discount the price of that easement is actually considered in the appraisal. So the value of what the public pays for that or the private individual pays for that parcel does reflect the fact that we're reserving that easement. So we're not taking anything from the private individuals. It's a condition essentially of a sale of state lands. And we hope that in most cases they are usable. Like I say, there are. We don't field check them all, so in some cases it's possible that the easements aren't usable. I would guess in 90% of the cases, at least, they probably are in fact a usable easement for the public, though.
Well, I disagree with that statement, especially in Southeast. I think if you took the average parcel and went out there at mean high tide, you would find very, very few people that would transverse that through the timbered shoreline versus walking down the beach between mean high tide and high tide.
Senator, you may be correct in Southeast. I'm looking at it from a statewide perspective, yeah. And a lot of other areas of the state, particularly where it's, you're dealing with lakes and rivers, those shorelines are generally pretty often accessible. Like along rivers in particular, where we reserve these easements, there you don't have, unless the water level is low, you don't have a public, if we don't reserve a public access, for example, along the Susitna River, there is no way for a fisherman to walk along the shoreline, and there often are well-established trails for people to move along those shorelines. Like I said, in Southeast, it may be true because of the nature of the shoreline that there's less of them that are usable, but on a statewide perspective, I still think it's probably close to 90% of them are, in fact, probably a usable easement.
Well, I would have to say that the extrapolation of Southeast Alaska would go all the way up to coastal Alaska and around, and that I think you're more correct when you're talking about rivers and lakes. The issue of having two 50-foot public access easements adjacent to someone's parcel, I'm wondering what purpose that serves. A 50-foot access easement above high tide and a 50-foot public access easement below high tide. Having 100 feet in front of a particular person's property.
Senator, through the chair, that would provide the opportunity for people to use the, well, for the most, in most cases, the shoreline, the easement offshore doesn't exist because we don't, in most cases, that's state-owned, so.
Well, I would agree in most cases, but when you convey uplands to a municipality or a particular person, private person, you have the 50-foot easement, and then when you, some years later, convey tidelands, and you put an easement, then there's 50 feet. And it seems like the intent is for public access, but I'm just kind of confused why the public would need a 100-foot pedestrian easement and why someone should be subjected to trying to deal with those easements if you happen to have property or happen to be one of these individuals that happen to have a 100-foot access easement that is unspecified. It's not listed as a pedestrian easement. It's a public access easement. So it's fairly broad in what somebody could use it for.
Senator, through the chair, that is true that we haven't, it is not defined in statute or regulation as to exactly what uses are allowed on those easements.
So you really have no comment on the issue of going from 50 to 100 feet, if that's not excessive, it seems.
It really depends on the topography. I mean, in some cases, you could probably, and it depends on the tide. It depends on a lot of circumstances that are pretty site specific. If you, an area where there isn't a lot of tidal influence and it's fairly flat terrain, you may only need 10 feet for those because it's primarily a pedestrian easement. But in areas where you've got a rocky shoreline or, like you say, timbered shoreline, You may need to deviate at least 50 feet inland to keep using the shoreline, or offshore, the same thing. You know, it kind of depends on the nature of the topography. So it's, you know, the 50 feet was put in long before I was here. It's been in there, as far as I can tell, in the regulation since about 1976. And I think that was just considered a reasonable width that could accommodate, you know, differences in terrain and things like that.
Well, from my past experience dealing with planning and zoning issues, when you're dealing with public access easements, a lot of them, or not even so much public access easements, but just access easements, they're 20 feet wide, which would allow somebody to run utility corridors and driveways, which is a substantially more has substantially more space requirements than a pedestrian easement. And I still come back to the issue of 50 feet with a restriction of not being able to put any structures within that easement. And I grant you that there's some deviation from that for docks and other related, you know, shoreline infrastructure.
We haven't had a lot of people coming in and expressing a concern about that, in part because where you're in municipalities, they often, like Mat-Su Borough, I believe their setback for buildings from the shoreline is actually 100 feet, and in a lot of municipalities there already are fairly significant setbacks for building structures that are greater than the 50 feet. So we don't get a lot of requests from people who want to build something within that 50-foot easement. Like I say, partly because I think a lot of the municipal ordinances don't allow building within 50 feet of the shoreline anyhow. So
I would disagree with that statement also. Some of them have larger setbacks. Some of them have setbacks to zero. And a lot of them in and around southeast will allow you to go to a zero on the waterfront for setbacks. But the standard setback we find around this area is roughly 20 feet for front setbacks. Now, when you have this 50-foot easement along the shoreline, which you'll find in southeast Alaska is virtually unpassable and very few people you'll find would ever use it. They would walk down the beach somewhere, if it was high tide, somewhere between high tide and high tide to stay out of the heavy timber and out of the cliffs and so on and so forth. How does somebody get some relief from this? What would be the process they would go through, and particularly what would be the process someone would go through if you happen to have 100 feet of this easement in front of his house or his property?
Senator, through the chair, the process would be that they would apply for an easement, either a vacation of a portion or all of the easement, depending on what their specific interest was.
And who would they apply to?
They would apply to DNR for that, although I think if it's actually within a municipality, they also have to go through the municipal platting.
Senator Stedman, might I suggest, if this is a problem southeast, maybe we need to look at a bill to change it.
Yeah, I mean and let me just take the lead from the chairman here. I don't think this probably just isn't really the point in time, I guess, to delve into this issue. But let me just make one other quick comment,
okay,
and then I'll get back to that. I think you'll find that a lot of people don't reapply for the relief from this 50-foot easement because, frankly, they ignore it, and the state doesn't enforce it. And that leads to a whole other set of problems. Again, maybe that's something that we should look at. It is in regulations and in the statutes, I think, what I recall, that can be defined by the legislature. So I think maybe it's time if the state isn't going to have some reasonableness in dealing with people in this area, that we actually take a look at going in and defining it in statute so we can ensure we have public access to our waterways, which I think all Alaskans want, and we also don't have suppressive actions from the state against private property rights. There's a balance there, and I think in this case it's out of balance. And one size clearly does not fit all anymore in this case than it does when we're dealing with our schools.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Very specific questions and issues you have. And
right.
Clearly, if there's a problem, you might want to schedule it for another meeting and being on here to lay out their application process and give you a full briefing on that. Because I apologize. I just went through it very superficially just to give an overview of what it is and ask Dick to be online. I didn't tell him that was going to come up.
Well, I thought you did a very good job, actually.
Thank you.
You did. You did a very good job.
Okay. And, Senator Seeker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions, if I might be allowed the leeway. First of all, I'd like to say, you know, Ms. Cunning, I really appreciate the depth of knowledge that you have in these issues. And we've talked before, so I've seen even more than what you've presented here. But I have a couple of questions, just maybe for the record, and we're talking about some of these things, talking about navigable waters, submerged lands. You mentioned the 1953 Submerged Lands Act. You know, that act, I think, sometimes maybe is overlooked in terms of how we as a legislature view the ownership of the submerged lands and the water column and the things that are in the water column. And I wonder if you could maybe just very briefly summarize what the Submerged Lands Act did and how that affects us in terms of ownership. I know it's a tough process.
Yeah, first I want to lean on Dick. Dick!
I know that the problem came because the legislature, Congress did this because of an adverse Supreme Court ruling that overrode the 3-mile rule. And, so go ahead from there.
Senator, through the chair, this is Dick Miles again with DNR. My understanding is the purpose of that act was essentially to confirm that the states did own out to the 3-mile limit in all states. And then when Alaska became a state in 1959, I believe that act is actually specifically referenced in the Statehood Act, that the Statehood Act confirmed that the state of Alaska did in fact own from the shore out to 3 miles to the edge of the territorial waters. So that's for the primary significance of that act was to confirm lands under those waters along the shoreline.
And if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, that ownership included not just the land underneath those submerged lands, but also everything in the water column. Am I correct?
The management of the resources within the water column. That is correct. There are some exceptions to that, though, because if there were pre-statehood withdrawals, if there were withdrawals of land prior to 1953 or prior to statehood, in which the intent of the withdrawal was to defeat the state's title and to include federal management of resources, that had to be very clearly laid out. There are some of those in some places.
Which is pretty clearly laid out in the Dinkum-Sands case.
That's correct. The court has said that.
And Senator, this is Dick Larkin, that's also the issue that we're dealing with in Glacier Bay and then the Southeast Highlands as well.
Correct. All right. Thank you. I guess one other question I have is in terms of the quiet title issue that you talked about. If I understand, ANILCA says that they have authority, that their authority only applies to federal lands, to which are lands to which in the act says are the lands to which the federal government holds title. If they, through ANILCA, claim management authority in navigable waters for terms of managing fish for subsistence, have they not indeed clouded the title to those navigable waters and making it subject to the Quiet Title Act, action under the Quiet Title Act?
I've heard that argument. The Ninth Circuit Court decision in Katie John was very specific in its wording that the federal priority under ANILCA Title 8 only applies, could be applied to those waters in which there's a federal reserved water right. For both those waters within the federal enclave and those waters adjacent to the federal unit where there is a claim of a federal reserved water right. The navigability, the term navigable, was used in that phrase in the Ninth Circuit Court's final decision. I think you all know that the state legislature and state just filed suit on the issue of the failure of the federal agencies to actually apply for the Federal Reserve water rights, particularly in those waters outside the units, which would be an expansion of the public land, was a public lands definition expansion by the Ninth Circuit Court. Since there's not an application on filed through the state process, which is what they're required to do under the federal Supreme Court, if they're going to file for Federal Reserve water rights, they have to do that through a state process. Since they have not applied through the state process, we can't know where the beginning and end points are in those waters that are outside the units that they are claiming they have this jurisdiction. I would like to clarify one other piece, though, and that is we frequently see kind of a misnomer in the press, and we even see it in publications that come out of the federal government. It's something we need to all be very much on guard for. The federal court and the federal law did not grant the federal agencies management authority over fish and wildlife. That is a right of the state that was not affected by ANILCA. It's in 1314 of ANILCA. Nothing in ANILCA changed that relationship. All that the federal authority is related to the allocation to provide a federal priority to the federally eligible subsistence user. Allocation of harvest, take, is a regulatory tool that's just a tool of management. It is not the actual management and responsibility for the conservation of species. That is retained by the state.
Well, when you're using a tool to fix a car, you're fixing the car. So I don't buy into that rather weak argument.
We just try really hard not to use the right word management and fishing game so that we make it clear that we're talking about allocating.
I understand that. Now, one other thing in that regard, I understand the Ninth Circuit Court talked about reserve water rights, but if I'm mistaken, that decision specifically said it was avoiding the argument of title because I think they avoided it because they knew they'd lose the argument. But so has the state ever asserted the title and management issue?
Yes.
Where?
In numerous ways. And your question is very broad.
I understand.
When we are reviewing, for example, the federal land management planning document, we are very much on guard that they recognize our ownership and jurisdiction over navigable waters, both within and without of the units, that we manage those boating access and other activities on those. So we monitor all of those plans to be sure that that's appropriately recognized. There's some pre-stated withdrawals that are very difficult, and in those cases where they don't want to agree with us on our management and ownership, we've asked that they at least recognize that there's a dispute in their management plan. That helps the public know that the sovereigns are arguing about it and makes it a little clearer. But we don't ever give up our ownership and management position in any of those. In the case of the federal subsistence program, based on the Federal Reserve Water Rights and expansion of the federal public lands, that is it's an uncomfortable situation for everybody. It's difficult to work through. As long as they are exercising their responsibility under the federal court decision to assure that federal subsistence priority, that's what the court gave them that authority to do.
And one final question, Mr. Chairman. In the matter of the public trust lands, waters, as I understand that, I, as a citizen of Alaska, am a beneficiary of that trust. But also as a legislature, I'm a trustee. Does that confer on me some diminished responsibilities?
Mr. Chairman, that's my interpretation, but I'm not an attorney. I'm a geologist.
Right. But you've studied this. I understand that. In your opinion, okay.
That's my opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to say I was very impressed with the presentation, very thorough for the time allotted. Got one question. State of Alaska is entitled to 102.5 million acres, whatever. How many acres have we selected now? How many acres, how many acres remain to be selected? And Senator Murkowski has helped by providing additional staff in BLM to bring about a fast conclusion to our selection of lands. And is that in 2008, 2009?
I referenced it in the slideshow, and I think Dick will probably give you the actual figures. But BLM is expediting the conveyance process to both the corporations and to the state. And in fact, they've even gone one step farther in that they are actually providing funds to DNR in order for DNR to be able to react to those conveyances so that they can review them and reserve the easements and review navigability associated with those easements.
Right. Okay.
Dick, did you want to give any actual numbers?
Yeah, Senator, this is Dick Marley's again. Actually, all of our statehood grants, including like mental health and all that, which DNR is responsible for securing, come to about 105 million acres of land. We have received either a patent or what's called tentative approval to about 90 million acres. Of that 90 million acres, we patent to about half that. I think it's like about 46 million acres. The remainder of the 90, which would be million acres, we have in what's called a tentative approval status, which means the state has working title to the land, but it's not surveyed and we don't have a patent to it. So a part of the major cost actually for the accelerated land transfer process is associated with surveying that 44 million acres plus conveying to us the remaining 15 million acres and then also surveying that so that the survey part of it is then the 44 million that's TA plus the 15 million acres more that we're supposed to get. So that's kind of what the goal of the accelerated land transfer process is from the state's end. There's also two other major components of that. One is that BLM is trying to resolve finally the native allotments issue because there's still over 3,000 native allotments that BLM has to convey. And so as part of the accelerated land conveyance process, they're trying to resolve that. And then they're also trying to finalize the entitlements to the native corporations under ANCSA. Under ANCSA, the corporations, I believe, received close to 48 million acres of land, and they've got about 8 million acres more that the federal government wants to transfer to the native corporations. So the BLM accelerated conveyance is three-pronged in that it's, like, say, dealing with allotments, ANCSA conveyances, as well as the state.
Okay, thank you for that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I can be so bold as to offer my opinion on something else that you haven't asked for. I get my opportunity here. One of the things both DNR and Fish and Game deal with is they're dealing through these dicey and complex land issues, which there's been a number of really good questions come up about. It entails very extensive research into the land records to try to figure out who owns what. We have what we commonly call a situation of being a non-recording state. That is, a person that transfers property, if he sells property to somebody, or you get it through the court, or you get it through an inheritance or some other manner, there's no requirement for that property to be recorded. And this makes it very difficult for people who are trying to research land status and answer questions, like even on the research we showed you on Montana Creek with the two and a long easements that are on there and it's discontinuous and stuff. If you are researching that land record and you go back, what we'll find, we find these fascinating cases where an individual owned land, never recorded it, or maybe recorded it originally. He's died. It's been passed to his wife. His wife remarried. The land was given away in an inheritance. The heir that received it lost it in a divorce battle, and it's gone through five different people and never been recorded. And we have a devil of a time trying to find those. So if I could just suggest that one thing that would be helpful would be if at some point people were required to record the land transactions, at least from this point forward.
Never thought of that.
That's a good point.
Further questions? Well, that's the end of it. I would once again like to thank Ms. Cunning for her presentation. I think she did a very good job. We're going to have a test on all our handouts next Friday.
Just quite a bit.
And with that, we'll end the meeting.
If you don't think you can answer your handouts, leave them for me and I'll